Hi, this is Tavi Greiner, Astronomy.fm's Vice President of Communications. If you enjoy our programming, please let us know with a donation to astronomy.fm/donate. We really do rely on your support, and it's true, every little bit counts.
AFM. The sun is yellow, Sirius is blue, and good grief, the sky is too. I like listening to the voice of the universe, Astronomy.fm Radio.
Hello and welcome to another edition of Comet Watch. We have our special guests waiting to join us. They will identify themselves just after the usual gubbins. Yes, the shipping forecast will be in a few moments. As before we do that, let my co-hosts say hello.
Good evening, I'm Neil Norman.
Hi.
And I'm Mary McIntyre.
And we are Comet Watch. Now, let's get started with the latest discoveries. Oh, we've got a lovely now. I'm going to kick off with this. May the 4th, Warchalt Boomplard reports a Kreutzgruppe comet in real-time C3 images.
May the 8th, Warchalt Boomplard reports a Kreutzgruppe comet in real-time C2 images.
On May the 9th, Masanori Uchina reports a Kreutzgruppe comet in real-time C2 images.
May 11th, the Warchalt Boomplard reports a Kreutzgruppe comet in real-time C2 images.
And May the 12th, Masanori Uchina reports a Kreutzgruppe comet in real-time C2 images.
May the 13th, and Masanori Uchina reported a Kreutzgruppe comet in real-time C3 images.
May the 13th, Warchalt Boomplard reports a Kreutzgruppe comet in real-time C2 images.
And on May the 16th, Warchalt Boomplard reports a Kreutzgruppe comet in real-time C2 images.
May the 17th, and Warchalt Boomplard reports a Kreutzgruppe comet in real-time C3 images.
May the 18th, the Warchalt Boomplard reports a Mayer Group comet in real-time C2 images. Nearly made a mistake there.
May the 20th, Mikhail Kusiak reports a Mayer Group comet in real-time C2 images.
May the 21st, and Masanori Uchina reported a Mayer Group comet in real-time C2 images.
May 21st, Mikhail Koyasov reports a Kreutzgruppe comet in real-time C2 images.
May the 24th, discovery of 2017 K1 stars reported.
May the 24th, and the discovery of the very exciting 2017 K2 pan stars was reported.
May 27th, Mikhail Koyasov reports a Kreutzgruppe comet in real-time C2 images.
May the 28th, Mikhail Kusak again reports a Kreutzgruppe comet in real-time C2 images.
May the 28th again, and 2016 WM48 Lemon reported as a comet.
May 29th, Masanori Uchina reports a Kreutzgruppe comet in real-time C2 images.
May the 31st, Warchalt Boomplard and Mikhail Kusak reports a Kreutzgruppe comet in real-time C2 images.
On June the 1st was the discovery of 2017 K3 periodic Gasparovich was reported.
On June 1st, discovery of 2017 K4 Atlas reported.
June the 1st again, we have the discovery of 2017 K5 Pan-STARRS reported.
On June the 1st again was the discovery of 2017 K6 Jacques reported.
And June the 2nd was the update. If there has been no recent updates, try the German Comet Group page or Yasichi Yoshida's page for information, or the LIGO the Spanish American De Astronomica for observations. I can't say the word. I just want to say well done to Cristavo. Yes, another comet under his hat. So, now we move on to current comet magnitudes May 31st, an observable region as of May 31st. So, it's my old friend Johnson 2015 V2, magnitude 7.5, fading. It's visible 50 degrees north to 55 degrees south, visible all night. Last observed May 2017.
Then we have Pan-STARRS 2015. ER61, currently magnitude 8 and fading, observable 45 degrees north to 65 degrees south. That's visible in the morning. Last visual observation was in May 2017.
And next we have 41P, Tuttled Giacobini Kreisach, magnitude 10.5, but fading now, 50 degrees north to 55 degrees south, all night object, last reported in May.
Then we have Lovejoy 2017 E4. Oh, sorry, no. 71P Clark. I beg your pardon, folks. I jumped a comet. Magnitude 11 steady, 40 degrees north to 90 degrees south. It's an all-night object, last visually observed May 2017.
Lovejoy 2017 E4, magnitude 12 and fading, currently in solar conjunction, observable. Last visual observation reported in April 2017.
Next, we have Pan-STARRS 2016 R2, magnitude 13 question mark. It should be brightening, but currently at poor elongation, yet to be observed.
And, of course, my old friend, 29P Schwachmann-Wachmann 1, magnitude 13 question mark. It varies. Visible 45 north to 80 south. Morning object, last visually observed May 2017. This is worth observing, folks. There is an ongoing program to monitor this comet. Please, if you can, get photographs, send them to Richard Miles, or if you can't get a hold of Richard, get a hold of us at on the Comet Watch page, the Comet Watch page, and we will pass them on.
Okay, then we have 65P Gunn, currently at 13.5 and steady, observable 30 degrees north to 65 south. Best observed in the evening. Last visual observation, none as yet reported.
Next, we have Pan-STARRS 2015-01, magnitude 14 and steady, 50 degrees north to 30 degrees south, an all-night object, but is yet to be observed.
And, of course, last but not least, guess another old friend, 73P Schwachmann-Wachmann, magnitude 14 is beginning to fade, 15 degrees south to 30 degrees south, early morning. Last visually observed March 2017. But I hasten to add, this is available through iTelescope. So if you can get on and image it, this is the best way to do it, folks. Okay, so one just quick comment is to make that the observational region is an approximate indication of the latitude at which the comet may be seen. Under good conditions, comets are visible outside its range. This is mostly, obviously, for the UK. If it's visible from the UK, otherwise for 40 South or the equator as appropriate. The last visual observation is as received by the BAA Comet section. Details are often updated on the basis of observation published elsewhere. So, as I say, please help out. Send your observations into the BAA. I'm sure Dennis and Nick James will be overjoyed to have them, and they will get published and saved. Now, welcome back, Mary. We missed you last month.
Oh, thank you.
And, of course, I also wanted to quickly touch base on the fact that is the very first star maps has come out about noctilucent clouds, one of your favourites, I believe.
Oh, absolutely.
So I do recommend watching it, even though it's a little bit, it's not really comets, but it is nice to see Messrs. Coleshaw, Abel, and I can't remember Pete's last name, so he'll probably kill me. But thank you there, Lawrence. Nice to see them together as back as a team. I really did enjoy watching Pete and Paul when they used to be on the Sky at Night DVDs and stuff, because they were always good fun. And now, of course, they've got John to add in all the fun voices. So it is good humoured and it is full of information. So pop along. It's available through the Sky at Night magazine website.
Yeah, we've had some nice NLC displays now from the UK. They were a bit slow getting going, but they have started, so keep your eyes out for them.
Yes, and they have some very cracking good pictures on the shores. I think it's time to introduce our guests. I'm just going to pause a quick while, because we're trying to get a hold of one of our guests online, so I'm just going to pause. Would our guests this month like to introduce themselves? Our special guest from Nematode, would you like to go first?
Hi, this is William Stewart. I'm the co-founder of the Nematode Meteor Detection Group, and we cover the ablation layer in and around the British Isles.
And our two friends from Northolt, welcome back to the show, and please do reintroduce yourselves.
Yeah, hi, Nick. I'm Daniel Bamberger. I'm from Germany. And, yeah, I'm running Northolt Branch Observatories together with my friend Guy Wilds, who's on the show today with us.
just need Guy to introduce himself.
Hi, I'm Guy Wells. I'm from North Atlanta Observatory with Daniel Bamberger.
So, of course, this month we are going to go slightly off track. We're going to talk about not only comets, but we're going to talk about some asteroids, meteor showers, their parents, and we have William with us to tell us all about Nematode, how it, what it does, how it does it. So I think if it's okay with everybody, let's kick off with the fact we have a very nice comet possibly coming. I hear K2 is looking very promising at the moment.
Yes, it's really an interesting object. It's been discovered at an unusually large distance of 16 astronomical units, with it, which is almost unprecedented. And yeah, it's going to come to perihelion in 2023, so we'll have a long time to discuss if it's going to get bright or not. And yeah, it's well, not yet certain if it's a new comet or a periodic comet, so very uncertain if it's going to get bright or stay a binocular target. But a very interesting object.
Now, I know that Neil's been looking into this on the Comet Watch page. Have you been looking at this at all, Guy?
Yeah, we've done some follow-up measurements of this object. It's pretty faint, but we managed from London, just about.
Yes, it's already showing some activity, so we can already see a coma, even though it's still magnitude 19, but it's unusual that an object is active at a distance. Very interesting.
And I think one of the main things that's exciting is Dave Jewett has asked for the Herschel Space Telescope to be put on it straight away. So that's a sign that this could be something special indeed.
Yeah, David Jewett is asking for a Hubble time on June 27th, if I'm right. So we will get some Hubble events if the proposal is successful.
Now, what kind of special things are we hoping to see from this comet?
Well, it depends if it's if it depends on its orbit. The observation arc is short. We've only had about 3 weeks for observation. It's not yet certain if this comet has an elliptic orbit or if it's a completely new one. If it's a new one, then well, not that unusual that the very volatile components are at a distance, and then well, it will probably be a binocular target. If it's a periodic comet, then it must be very large, and well, it may become quite a sight. It may not be but it could become a naked eye object.
Now, and of course, the other thing of interest that's happening shortly is Asteroid Day. Neil, I know we've discussed this in the past. I'll let you have a quick chat about this.
Yes, of course. I mean, Asteroid Day is a very important thing. I mean, everybody's looking out for these things that are potentially going to be hitting the Earth. Of course, Brian May is very famous for doing it. I think actually the real person to talk to is Daniel and Guy. They track asteroids all the time. So I think that would be a good thing for them to come in on.
Yeah,
so yeah, thanks, Neil. Well, Asteroid Day is going to going to try to raise awareness about asteroids, as you said. And of course, Brian May is the very popular figure. There are many others. And yeah, Asteroid Day will be June 30th, for those who know. And there will be many events around the world with broadcasts and a lot of stuff on social media. And yeah, Guy and I will be in London for an event at Imperial College. So, yeah. Very excited.
Very.
Mary?
I'm looking at the one...
No, I was going to let Guy speak. I think you was about to say something, Guy.
Yeah, well, we track asteroids every night. So Asteroid Day, of course, is fantastic. The general public, you know, get to hear about asteroids and, like Daniel says, raise awareness of a possible impact threat. But, yeah, hopefully we'll be broadcasting live to the Asteroid Day website on the 30th of June. Maybe some of you chaps will see us.
Yeah, we're hoping so.
I think beginners might struggle to observe asteroids themselves, so I think it's really good. It looks like the website's got an event guide on there, so if anybody wants to go and find an event in your area, then that's worth going and having a look at. Can we put the link to the website on the show notes, perhaps? And
yes,
make sure
most certainly, yes. It's not a problem. I have to admit, I really do like the work that Brian May's been doing with this particular project, because it is something obviously which is of vital importance, just down to the fact that the last time something hit us, it wiped out the dinosaurs. That was Chicxulub, I believe. That ended the reign of the dinosaurs, and the next time something sizable comes our way, hopefully, because we have a space program, he says, we should now be able to do something about it. If it had been in the Middle Ages or something, and something sizable, we probably would have been put back to a near extinction event anyway. But now we can actually do something about it. We have the capability to go to low Earth orbit. Hopefully within 2 years we'll be back in high Earth orbit and beyond, and that will also then give us the capability of perhaps doing something, even if it's finding some way to deflect them. That might be a possibility. But however, once we get back to high Earth orbit, then we can go beyond, and now we can actually do something again. I know, it's a pet hobby horse of mine. We should never have stopped. We did, because nobody was willing to do PR for spaceflight when the Apollo program ground to a halt due to the lack of interest. Basically, people started working on the shuttle program. The shuttle program stopped, and we have nothing really, even within international cooperation, that can go to the moon or beyond. And it's something we really do need to fix because of these issues.
Yes, and one thing to... sorry, Mary. One thing to remember...
No, just you go first.
Yes, sorry, thank you. One thing to remember is June 30th, the day Asteroid Day has chosen, is the anniversary of the Tunguska event in 1908. And Nick, you mentioned Chicxulub, the asteroid that killed the dinosaur. But of course, well, these events are rare, but impacts of smaller asteroids, like the one that exploded in 1908, these happen more often, maybe every couple of centuries.
Agreed.
And these objects could destroy a city. If Tunguska had happened a few hours earlier, it could have destroyed London.
Exactly. And, of course, we had the Chablinsky event, which did bring a lot of damage to the city, most of it to glass because of the supersonic booms. But it really drove home that these objects can come from any particular direction, not necessarily where we're registered, we're always looking.
Yes, and already a small one can confirm it. I mean, Chelyabinsk, a diameter of less 20 meters, which is quite small. And so it's really necessary to find these objects and to track them, and that's what a lot of observers around are doing, including us. And that's why Asteroid Day is important.
Well, the other important thing is, of course, with people like yourself and Guy and other amateur astronomers throughout the world and the Space Guard teams. There's one in Wales that have got a very nice instrument they're using for this. There's the team that Jim Scotty is involved in. Had to get your name in there, Jim, somehow. but he was doing near-Earth objects during the period of Shoemaker-Levy 9. And to be honest, it just brings home, Shoemaker-Levy 9 brought home, I think at that point, just that there was so much stuff out there, and some of it occasionally does come our way. Luckily, the comet shattered and impacted in Jupiter, probably a lot better for Jupiter than it would have been for us, given the tremendous blotches it created, for want of a better word, on the face of Jupiter. And those were surviving for quite a long period. If that had been the Earth, then that would have been meant quite a lot of damage to the planetary atmosphere. And certainly, if they'd hit home, hit solid Earth, they'd have put a lot of material, perhaps causing what is termed a nuclear winter. So the work is very obvious. I agree, it's totally important, and it's really great that members of the amateur astronomical community are doing this work, because it takes away the element, oh, NASA isn't going to tell us if there's something coming. I got news for you. Every amateur astronomer in the world is going to know if something's coming, because we talk to each other. We are on social media, we email, we Skype, we meet up. I'm sorry, if something is spotted, the information is disseminated overnight. And of course, the Minor Planets Clearing Center, they get the information, they check it, and they push it out, because they need people to do follow-ups so they can actually do a more accurate prediction and orbit for the item. And this is especially so with near Earth objects and with comets and with asteroids. They track them. Bill Marsden, at the Minor Planet Center had a saying, if it moves and if it explodes, I want to know about it. And he got to know about it. People called him, they wrote to him, they sent him telegrams. They even emailed him, and he would be on it. He would have the information. He'd be able to say, yeah, okay, no worries, this is a false alarm, or yeah, this is something we really need to track. And he would get the information out there to the amateur astronomer community, as well as the professionals, for this object to be picked up, to be tracked. And even NASA will then start looking for it using radar. And that's what they've done in the past with some of the near-Earth objects. They will image these things with radar so they can see what the actual shape is like. Is it tumbling? Is that going to affect the orbit or not? And that all goes back to the Minor Planet Center. It all gets put into the computers so they can crunch out an orbit, which is why we're able to say near-Earth objects so-and-so or asteroids so-and-so will be able to be seen at this particular point on when. It's because of the work done this way.
That's right. He famously said a few years ago that there was more money spent on disaster movies about asteroid impacts than there was on actually researching them. Is that still the case, or have we upped the game now?
I think that's one for Guy and Daniel.
It's a good question. I don't know the budget of some of the movies. I believe their budget is too high, given the outcome. But things are changing. There's a lot of people who think hard and who try to do stuff. NASA is working with JPL and others to make things more effective, and their budget is always a problem, and always has been. That's why Astro Day is important. Not only about raising awareness in the general public, but also raising awareness so politicians get pushed on these projects that are needed to discover asteroids.
Oh, I've just realised. The really nice thing is I've got the day off too.
There will be a lot of broadcasts and activities and all over TV and social media.
Well, yes, they're doing a 24-hour live broadcast on June 30th.
Yes.
But whether or not I shall watch it for 24 hours is another matter. But, I will be popping in and out on it to see what is going on. Now, moving on slightly to our next item. Okay, it's about the. We're going to quickly, briefly talk about meteor showers and comets, and then I would like to bring William in to talk about Nematode. So, we know which comets feed which meteor streams. We know, for instance, that there's been a connection between. I'm just pulling up my notes here. Oh, come on. Okay. There's a connection between 55P Temple Tuttle and the Leonids, C1861G1 Thatcher and the April Lyrids. There's also a connection between Halley's Comet and the Orionids. And this is something that is actually being built on even to this day. We're identifying more and more connections between meteors and comets. So every time a comet comes through the Earth's neighbourhood, it leaves a stream of dust and little bits and pieces of rock and ice and whatever behind. When the Earth goes through that particular stream, we get a meteor shower. Now, I think the first time they started suggesting this seriously, and I know that Neil's a historian on this type of stuff, was back in 1861, and they were one comet, comet's 1861 J1 Tebbit was suggested as having a link to a stream. Now, they've suggested that the Perseid and the Leonids could be cometary fragments, whereas Olmsted compared the material of meteors to what formed cometary tails. Now, and he remarked on the great eccentricity of meteor orbits and their similarity to cometary orbits. So by the time of Kirkwood in 1861, it had been suggested that periodic meteors were debris from comets. So by the appearance of J1 Tebbit's comet back in 1861, they were looking for comets that matched the orbits of known meteor showers, in particular the Leonids, the Perseids and the April Lyrids, rather than looking for meteors that match the newly discovered comet, which is the present practice. This came to fruition with the discovery of 109P Swift Tuttle. Now, this was a 100% confirmed it's associated with the Perseids. That was by Schiaparelli in 1867. And as I said earlier, followed by the discovery of 55P Temple Tuttle, and that was associated with the Lyrids. Then G1 Thatcher with the. Sorry, Tuttle was the Leonids, and Thatcher was with the April Lyrids. Then, of course, it was realised that the Orionids linked to Halley's Comet. And this is something that is still looked at today to find if there are other comets which are feeding meteor showers. And this is where I'd like to bring in a new guest to the show, William Stewart. William is the man behind the Nematode Network. And William, would you tell us about what Nematode is, how it works, and what it does?
Okay, so first off, I'll just explain the name a little bit. Somebody might be confusing it with worms. As ever in astronomy, you're nothing without a good acronym. So Nematode actually stands for Network for Meteor Triangulation and Orbit Determination. Bit of a mouthful, but essentially what we do is we use a combination of high-sensitive video cameras fitting a video stream into computers which run motion detection software. And we monitor the night sky every night when it's dark, looking for meteors. And if a meteor passes through the field of view, that gets recorded as a discrete video clip. Now, the clever bit is that by working together as a group, there's over 40 observers in the group over here in the British Isles, over 60 cameras in operation. we coordinate our efforts to simultaneously monitor the same part of the ablation layer. The ablation layer is that part of the atmosphere at an altitude between 80 and 100 kilometers. And if you have two or more observers observing the same part of the ablation layer and a meteor passes through it, we can combine our observations to triangulate the trajectory that the meteor took through the atmosphere. And from that, we can back calculate what the orbit was of the meteoroid before it entered the Earth's atmosphere. So we can then use statistics to build that up and build up a statistical match between orbits. And yes, we can confirm that the orbits of the Perseids and the Leonids and the like and the Orionids all match the progenitor comets, which Nick mentioned earlier. The key thing, I think, however, it's worth noting here is that in many cases, we do see meteors which occupy very similar orbits, and so it's reasonable to assume that they are the result of a common parent body, but we don't know what that comet is. It's out there somewhere. If it still exists, it was in a particular orbit at some point in the past, depositing debris along that orbital trajectory, but we can't match it today. We don't know where that comet nucleus, if it still exists, we don't know where that is. The interesting thing, though, is that if the debris trail intersects the Earth orbit, maybe that extinct comet nucleus is also going to intersect the Earth orbit too.
So interestingly, we not only by working out the orbits of these particular fragments, it might give us a clue where to look for the parent body, and ironic tie, it's a direct tie into what Daniel and Guy are doing. Which is
absolutely right, yeah, definitely. It's a bit like the folk tale of Hansel and Gretel leaving a trail of blade crumbs. So I think of it like comets leaving a trail of blade crumbs, and perhaps that can lead us to the comet itself.
Yeah, it's interesting that we are doing complementary stuff. As Nick mentioned earlier, the Perseid meteor shower is caused by Comet Swift-Tuttle, and this object has once been dubbed the single most dangerous object to humanity, because it's very large and it intersects Earth orbit, and it's not going to hit soon, that's for sure. But if it hits, it will be a much greater event than Chicxulub, which hard to imagine. I find it interesting that we are essentially doing the same thing. We triangulate the position from taking images and calculate an orbit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
And the other thing that I find very interesting is that, as I'm sure you know, comets are relatively small objects compared to some of the sun and the planets, and their orbits get perturbed for all sorts of reasons, gravitational interactions, solar radiation pressure and the like, and the orbits get nudged around over long periods of time. And we see the same with cometary debris streams as well. So one of the best performing meteor showers right now is the Geminids. But if you wind the clock back 150 years ago, that particle stream didn't intersect with the Earth's orbit, and we didn't have the Geminid meteor shower. So these meteor shower trails do evolve with time, and who's to know what's going to, over time, start to intersect with the Earth's orbit, and we start to see a new meteor shower, and indeed which of the current performers are going to slowly fade away because they're the orbits of those particles moves away from the Earth's orbit.
Yeah, very good.
And does
point.
The debris stream itself kind of spread out and become less dense over time as well? Would that cause a reduction in meteor shower?
Yeah, you see each there's a number of factors at play here. If it's if the parent comet is in a relatively short period orbit around the sun, it's replenishing that debris trail on a regular basis. if it's a very long period comet, it's not replenishing the tail very often. But we see effects through gravitational perturbations and radiation pressure to actually, as you say, spread the orbits of those individual particles out a little bit. And we actually see what's known as mass sorting. So you end up with some of the larger, heavier particles on one side of the orbit and the smaller, lighter particles on the other side of the orbit. And hence, during a particular meteor shower, which might last for 2 or 3 days, you might see, you know, the larger, brighter ones towards the end of the shower and the smaller, fainter ones at the beginning of the shower. You see effects like that. But certainly,
it affects the length of the peak as well, doesn't it? Because sometimes the peak of a meteor shower is like literally a couple of hours, whereas other times it can be a couple of days. Yeah.
Well, even weeks. If you take the Perseids, they last, you know, from late July through to like to the end of August. But you know, you're right about some only lasting a few hours. The Quadlantids are very famous for that. Their maximum is the 4th of January. But you know, the weather in the Northern Hemisphere isn't brilliant at that time of year, and if you're clouded out on that night, you've missed them essentially for the year.
Well, actually, there's other ways you can do it if you're clouded out. I'm a radio amateur, so I have access to radio equipment. So I can use 2 meters or 70 sems to deliberately bounce signals off the ion trail from a meteor coming in. Or I can be listening for signals from a fair way away, which I wouldn't normally get. Because VHF and UHF being line of sight, they are not normally available to me. So radio detection is definitely very possible for this. So if you cloud it out, and you could always set up beforehand to do radio detection, and you can track the peak that way as well.
Yes, I believe there's
Go
on, William.
I was just saying. You can certainly do that. I actually operate a system here on radio which makes use of the GLAVS military radar in Dijon and Flance, and there's some back lobes from that which reach out and illuminate the ablation layer of the UK, and we're able to detect forward scatter from those.
And of course,
So that's pretty useful for detecting, you know, when the peak occurred. But the thing to remember is that when you see a detection, it could be a sporadic meteor, it could be a shower meteor. It's very difficult to tell the difference between the two.
Daniel?
Yeah, there's also a website where you can where they put on a live view of radio detections of meteors, I believe. I don't have
a link now. Yeah, if you just do a search on RMOB meteor, it'll pull that up.
Oh, thanks.
Yeah, and I'll make sure that goes into the show notes as well. And of course, the other nice thing is radio amateurs do actually have access to microwave frequencies, so we technically can run our own radar too, if we're that way inclined. I do know a couple of guys who used to go up that high, and they used to be up and active during meteor showers, purely for, as they said it, we're looking for a length distance for a radio record, and they do that. I think there's one guy in Romania who set the distance record for 2 meters VHF FM by using a meteor trail to bounce his signal off it, and he was deliberately steering. He was looking for the actual meteor itself. And then he would put his aerial onto it and then send a digital signal, wait for a confirmation via email.
Great.
Okay.
Now, what organizations are there out there for people who want to get involved in meteor studies and perhaps learn as much as they can and take part in observation programs?
Okay, so the first place it would start for anybody, you know, if they're anywhere in the world, would be the International Meteor Organization. And they've got a pretty good website, and they will show provide links to other more local or regional organizations. But the other thing which is quite useful is they list their members by country. So you can find a contact who's nearby to you to help you get into it. It depends how you what sort of what aspects of meteor observation you want to get into. We've already talked about the radio, and we've talked a little bit about the video. The visual observations are still extremely important, though you know the number of visual observers is decreasing as more technology is deployed. And the reason the visual side is so important is sort of relates to what I mentioned a few moments ago about the fact that these meteoroid streams, the orbits of them, evolve with time. Now, we've got quite a long and extensive historical record of visual observations of meteors. And, of course, the past 10 years, the video observations are coming to the fore now as well. But we don't have a good overlap between the two. So when we see a particular number of meteors in the video, how does that relate to what observers would typically see in the visually? And if we're going to try and figure out how these meteor streams are evolving with time, we need that sort of overlap to be able to relate the old observations, which were done visually, with the more modern observations done either with video or with radio.
So if you have people doing visual observations, what information do you need people to send in for this? What should they be recording?
Okay, so the key thing to do is to record the date and the time and the location and who you are.
Okay, do you need to do magnitude estimates as well?
Yeah, the meteor magnitude is very important information. So as well as recording the time that it occurred, actually about a second, if you can estimate the meteor magnitude as well and record that, that's very helpful information too. So if you're just starting out in this, I would certainly recommend getting in touch with your local astronomical society. They almost certainly will have somebody who's interested in this and can provide some additional guidance on that. Failing that, the British Astronomical Association, their website, has some very good notes on there about how to make visual observations of meteors.
Yes, interestingly, it was Nick James of the comet section who steered me your way concerning Nematode. And mm-hmm. I have got my camera at last. Now I've just got to get it mounted safely outdoors and set up something so I can connect it to the internet, which shouldn't mm-hmm. be taking me too long. Now, is there any particular type of camera you would recommend, and what software?
Okay, so the key thing to remember here is that we're observing the night sky in video. We're not taking an integrated image over a number of seconds. It's a video image, typically at about 25 frames per second. So you're going to need a camera which is quite sensitive. And the ones which have been found to be very good performers for this sort of work are the Watek 902 series. Now, the current model in production is the Watek 902 Ultimate. There is another, even more sensitive camera by the same company. It's the Watek 910. Now, these are relatively expensive cameras. You're talking about, for the 902 Ultimate, you're probably talking about £250. For the 910, you're probably looking over £400. So what I would always recommend is, if you're just starting out, keep an eye on eBay. And even the first generation, the Watek 902, the original version, you can pick those up secondhand for about maybe £50 or £60, something like that. And if you're not quite sure if this is for you, you don't want to spend too much money to begin with, I would get one of those and put it up in a CCTV housing that protects it from the elements, because you can let these run all night, every night, irrespective of the conditions. And then you need to get that video stream from the camera down to your computer. Now, the software which does the motion detection isn't very sophisticated software, so you can actually use relatively old PCs. I'm using old desktop PCs from about 10, 15 years ago. You know, some of them are still running in Windows XP, but they're more than adequate for the job. Software, a lot of people in Europe and Japan use what's known as UFO Capture. Don't be put off by the name. It is an extremely capable software platform for this sort of work. It's designed from the ground up, especially for this. There are other software platforms out there. There's Metric, and there's CAMS are two of the more notable ones. But I'd say the UFO suite is very capable in that it's an integrated suite. You've got the capture piece of it, which obviously is for capturing the meteors. There's then an analyzer part of it, which takes those individual observations and performs the analysis automatically. So this compares the start and end points of the meteor against the positions of the background stars. It knows your, it knows the date and the time and your location, and so it knows where those stars should be. So from that, it can work out the azimuth and elevation of the start and end points of the meteor trail. And what it also does is compares the pixel value of the brightest section of the meteor trail against the pixel values of the stars that are in the field of view, and from that it can work out the meteor magnitude. So when you've done all that for the dozens of meteors that you've collected on a particular night, we can then, as a group, and this is where the benefit of working collaboratively in a group comes to the fore, we can take those observations and look for matches. You know, have we seen the same meteor from more than one location? And we do that in a third part of the software suite called UFO Orbit. And that allows us to triangulate the start and end points of the meteor trail. The key thing about these is that they're video images, so we've got velocity information too, and obviously that's essential if we're working out what the orbit should be, what the orbit of the meteoroid particle was.
Now, I know that UFO is free. You can get it on a free trial for 1 month. Mm-hmm. But then you have to buy it. I've actually had a look at the software, and it's on my wish list. I'm going to have to admit it. The nice thing is, of course, I've just bought a camera. It's a 0.01 lux sensitive camera. It's got a dome housing. It's going to be going outside. I'm going to be running it during the daytime as well, because that's what the manufacturer recommends to keep condensation out. So I've got not only can you track an image, the meteors, and get the information, you've also got a very, very good weather camera. And I've always said every astronomer should have a weather station, and B, have an all-sky camera that records everything day and night, because it's all really part of it. In my personal book, the weather information I send to the Met Office, to the NOAA as well, because then it makes their forecasts better for you as astronomers. That's my take on it.
Well, beginners as well can get involved with BBC Weather Watchers, because whether you have a weather station or not, you can just include temperature, add photographs of something that represents the weather from your location, and they're feeding all that in to help with local forecasting, because the big weather stations that they historically use for forecasting are so spread out that it doesn't take local geography into account. So actually getting involved with weather, you can do that without any kind of equipment other than a smartphone that tells you what the temperature is. And it's actually a really good fun thing to do. I mean, we have a lot of varied weather in this country, so we might as well get used to it and learn to read it and learn to identify the clouds that are getting in your way. So that's the way I view it. I actually find the weather aspect quite a lot of fun. So,
is there any preferred housing for the camera?
So it depends on the focal length of the lens that you choose to use. The majority of of people who do the video meteor work tend to use lenses in the range of around 3.6 up to about 12 millimeters focal length. And you can accommodate those in standard CCTV housings. The ones you would typically use for security purposes, you'd see them mounted on the side of a building, maybe above a doorway, pointing down. They look about the size and shape of a shoebox with a window on the front. So we'd use those sort of style. Now, if you went for a shorter focal length lens, maybe a 2.6 millimeter lens, they wouldn't work so well in there because the window at the front isn't big enough, and part of your field of view would be cut off by the housing itself. So in that case, you would need a dome. And I operate a number of cameras, but one of them I operate is a 2.6 millimeter, and that's in a homemade dome assembly, and that operates at night. And I like that because it provides good contextual information about meteors. The longer focal lengths do give better data in terms of the positional accuracy in the sky that the meteor took. And they're not as susceptible to distortions introduced by wide-angle lenses. But sometimes you can miss the beauty of the meteor if you're only sort of zoomed in on a small part of the sky, and therefore having a wide field system where you can actually see a little bit of your local surroundings, be it trees or whatever. You can see, you know, three or four constellations in the same image, and you see a meteor passing through the image. Or passing through the field of view, rather. It's more akin to what you would see visually if you were, you know, just lying out in your garden on a sun lounger looking up at the night sky.
Interesting. How would they... assuming that our astronomer Joe Bloggs has now decided he's really hooked on the stuff, how does he get involved? How does he share the information?
Okay, well, there's a number of groups around the world. If you're in the British Isles, feel free to get in touch with me. I'm sure we can add the email address, the website address to the show notes. I regularly get contacted by people, not just in the UK, but also from further afield, interested in setting up cameras or indeed setting up networks. And what I can do is I can help them get in touch with people more local to them, to guide them in terms of people to collaborate with. This really is a team sport, so to speak. A sport's probably the wrong word, but working together as a team is where the real value comes in, because you can do this triangulation work in order to determine the original orbit of the meteoroid trail. So, if you have a look at the website, get in touch with me. There's contact details on there, and we can help out. The key thing I would say to begin with, though, is you don't have to spend very much money to get into this. You know, Nick, you mentioned earlier with the software, you do have to pay a license for that. I personally have found that to be the cheapest software I've ever purchased based on the number of hours used. That software is running on multiple cameras all night, every night, 365 days a year. And I've been running that for many years now. So it's pence per hour is probably even lower than that. I've certainly purchased more expensive software and hardly used it. And I'd say the PCs don't have to be expensive. You can pick up a lot of the gear secondhand off eBay. If you're stuck, again, I can help people out. I've ended up building systems for people. I've probably built over 24 of those things now. So if people need any help, get in touch first. Don't rush out and buy too much equipment up front, because we can probably save you some money.
I have to admit that I spent a lot of time looking long before I got in contact with yourself. I think I started looking about 2 or 3, maybe 4 years ago. Of course, a lot of the electronic shops that were around the area, they were willing to sell CCTV for security. They weren't willing to help you with find an enclosure that would work for your project. It was like, yeah, this is what we've got. This is what we record it on, which is,
yeah,
a DVR, you've got maybe three, four cameras. At most, you may need two back-to-back, I would have thought, perhaps, if you're using CCTV housings, unless, of course, you're going down the globe route, where you just need the one and it's the best, the highest possible spot you can get it to, possibly on the observatory roof, if it's a shed, or just put it on the garden shed, even, and link it into your house through a router. I know people that have done it that way.
Yeah, like mine are my cameras are well, the old Sky cameras sitting in a homemade box actually in the garden. I have to move it each time I cut the lawn, but the other ones are permanently mounted on the wall on the end of my garage, so they're fixed in position. I do get questions every so often from, you know, why your security cameras pointing at the sky not at the ground, but it helps with public engagement because you can start explaining it's actually that's not an accident, that they are deliberately pointed up for a good reason. And people are very interested in what you end up doing. And it's I'm still amazed at how much activity there is up there. So I'm using first generation 902s, and I'm picking up well over 3,000 meteors per camera per year. And it's surprising, you know, sometimes you go to bed, it's cloudy, you get up, it's cloudy, you just assume it's been cloudy all night. And lo and behold, you know, you check your captures from the night before, and there's maybe a 3/4 of an hour spell in the middle of the night where it's clear, and you capture quite a few meteors.
So how much data are you actually generating?
Oh, gigabytes of data. So each capture is typically about 60 megabytes. And then you've got about, as I say, over 3,000 captures per year. But, you know, computer memory is pretty cheap these days. You can pick up a terabyte now, a terabyte external drive for around about £40-£50. And that'll keep you going for 2 or 3 years in terms of backing up your data. I tend to keep all of the original data just in case I ever need to reprocess it.
Yeah, I hoard data as well. I mean, that's not bad, actually, because I filled a terabyte hard drive in 9 months just doing stuff with an SLR, so it sounds like it's not as memory hungry as it might sound at first.
Well, the cameras that we use, let's say, if we use the example of the 902, now the resolution is relatively low. You're typically looking 768 by 576 resolution. It is possible to use higher resolution cameras for this sort of work, but that ends up causing a number of other problems. First up, to get a camera that is as sensitive as the lower resolution versions, but with a high resolution sensor, that becomes prohibitively expensive. The data storage requirements increase quite dramatically too. And indeed, the image, the motion detection requirements increase too. There's a lot more pixels that you have to monitor in order to determine whether or not something's moving and whether you should actually trigger the recording. And hence, you can't get away with using an old desktop from 10 years ago running Windows XP. You need a much more modern PC, and that, again, adds to the expense. So it's getting the balance right between doing useful work and, yes, you could do better work, but I certainly don't have thousands at my disposal to dedicate to going down the high-resolution, high-definition route just yet. But as we know, the prices of those cameras is coming down all the time. Computers prices coming down all the time too. So in the years to come, I think we will see a transition over from the standard definition up to the high definition systems.
Well, I have to admit, I remember when the first CCD came out, and the asking price, I think, was something like, you need to remortgage your house to buy one. And it's now come down to something like £3,000 or £4,000. So it is quite a dramatic drop. And the thing is, the more of us that are demanding this equipment, the quicker the price is going to drop, the quicker it's going to become available. It's the old trickle-down threat, really, because a lot of it, in a lot of cases, is stuff that was originally created for the military, The military have used it, they've declassified it. What can we use it for in Civvy Street? Oh yeah, some astronomer. Let's go take some pictures of the sky. By gosh, they figured the cameras that they were originally built for spy satellites, for CCDs, got turned into the cameras at the observatory, at some of the top observatories in the world. After a few years, amateur astronomers got into them, got them, and of course, it's one of those lovely things. Of course, the camera companies are really trying to up the game, because the demand is there for more better cameras for low light acquisition. So really, you can hopefully say within about 2 or 3 years, we could have 1080p cameras for the night sky. I don't see it taking too long before that's within our grasp, reasonable cost.
Well, certainly, if you consider digital SLR technology, if you go out and buy a pretty decent spec one of those now, number one, it'll have a video mode, so you can record high definition video on it. But the other thing as well, it's got we're used to the traditional ISO settings of if you look at some of them now, they've got absolutely ridiculous ISO settings. You can really crank those up, and if you go on the web, you can actually see some pretty decent videos of the night sky that people have taken with the video mode and digital SLR cameras. But as I say, that's a huge amount of data that's being gathered, because that's a high resolution sensor, and to actually start to do motion detection on that is going to require quite a decent PC.
Well, as I say, processors are coming down in price. I looked at an octa-core 3 weeks ago. It's dropped by 10% already. They wanted about $350 for an 8-core 2.3 gigahertz processor. Last time I looked at it, it had dropped by about $30 in cost. They're coming down. It's becoming more easier to build these things. They're becoming cheaper to build them. And there is a demand out there. I know that I've shut my own computer. I've shut my own computer down. I've had an imaging processing program up. I've perhaps been watching a video on imaging processing at the same time. I'm running 2-3 screens, and the computer said, "Hang on a minute. I need to think. I've got too much stuff going on," and I've just had to sit and wait for it to process itself to a point where it's able to work again. But you know, that happens. Astronomy is very much a very CPU-intensive thing if you're doing imaging. And getting high-resolution pictures and looking for motion and stuff, that's going to put an awful lot of pressure onto the computer, so it's got to be up to date. This build I have here was originally a gaming build. I found that was the easiest way to go. That was the best route for me to go after talking to the company. I told him what I wanted to do for it. He said, "A what?" I patiently explained to him everything I expected this computer to do. Oh, he says, "In that case, you need a gamer's computer, because they are RAM intensive. They've got big CPUs in them. They've got video cards that have got their own CPUs, and up to 3 or 4 gigs of RAM on board them as well. So it was a case of, yeah, fine, okay, now give me a sensible price." I was quite shocked. I think I only paid about £200 for my computer. And
you can get old gaming ones on eBay as well, where people have been upgrading. So
yeah,
it's worth keeping an eye open.
And you can also upgrade them yourself.
Yeah, and to be honest, I can't stress enough that certainly with the standard definition, and the vast majority of video observers around the world are still in standard definition and are getting excellent data from it. You know, the PC is capable of running that, old desktops, you can pick them up on eBay for about £30-35, and they're more than adequate for the job. So we don't have to spend hundreds of pounds. A complete system you can easily do for between £400 and £500. Easily.
Well, that's
that includes your camera. That includes your camera, lens, your video card, your PC, the whole lot, housing, the whole lot.
And then you just got the software, and you're up and away.
Exactly. Yeah.
Well, I've noticed that we've already gone over an hour. and I'm going to get yelled at already for because it makes juggling the schedules a bit fun for them. We're actually at an hour and 4 minutes. William, thank you very much. I really do appreciate you coming on and talking to us about this. We will put a link to Nematode in the show notes. And I hope at some point you'll come back and we can talk some more.
Absolutely. There's loads more we can talk about. One thing I haven't mentioned is meteor spectroscopy.
We
can maybe talk about it next time, or if you want, we can talk about it now if you want.
You know what? To heck with it. Let's go for it. Let's talk about meteor spectroscopy, because I know Mary likes to do spectroscopy, and so does her husband.
He was out there last night till about 3 this morning doing spectroscopy on stuff, so it's definitely on our hit list to try and do it on a meteor shower.
Yeah, so we're all familiar with the old slit of light experiment where you pass a narrow slit of light through a diffraction grating and you can split the light up into its constituent colors. All familiar with that, yeah?
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
So if you think about a meteor, it's essentially a slit of light on the sky. It's a long, thin line of light in the sky. And so with the simple addition of a diffraction grating to the front of the lens on the camera system and the CCTV housing, if a meteor is light enough and is within your field of view and is heading in the right direction with respect to the lines in your grating, then you will actually get a spectrum of it. And from that, you can start to figure out some of the chemical composition of it. You can start to see the lines of sodium and magnesium and the like and silicates in there. And this is an area of research, and I'll be honest here, the guy who certainly got me into it and is extremely knowledgeable, one of the most knowledgeable people in the world actually, is Dr. Bill Ward, who's based up in the University of Glasgow. He recently became a doctor. He submitted his PhD and passed all the tests and exams and that. So congratulations to Bill on that. And he's been leading the way in terms of doing this sort of work, certainly here in the British Isles. And the interesting thing is that what's not clear to us is if we were to compare the spectra of meteors from one particular shower to another particular shower, would their chemical compositions be the same? Would they be different? We're still trying to figure that piece out. We certainly see differences between meteor spectra on terms of the relative abundances of certain chemical elements, but we still need quite a lot more data to be able to draw up what I would call a taxonomy of meteor chemistry, meteoroid chemistry. Obviously, it's a good taxonomy for meteorites because, you know, they're big chunks of rock that have come down. You can get them into a lab and you can do some very detailed analysis on them. And again, if you go on the web, you can start to see the different families of, carbonaceous clondites and the like. But in terms of meteors, we've got very, very limited data on those. And so we're keen to have more and more people fit diffraction gratings onto the front of their video systems. Because what can we do then is combine the chemistry data against the video data from which we can get the actual orbit of the meteoroid. So if we were able to say that meteors, a particular meteor that's seen, we can definitely confirm that that was a Perseid, or it was a an Orionid, or one of the more obscure showers, and it's got a particular chemistry when compared to a different meteor shower. Then we can start to draw some interesting conclusions then about where the progenitor object, where it came from originally. You know, where was it formed in the solar system?
And of course, the thing is, we can then look at the spectroscopy of the parent comet and compare it against that, which is another emerging field which a lot of amateurs are getting involved in as well.
Yes.
Yeah, that certainly is. And maybe some of the experts on the spectroscopy of comets can guide me here. My working assumption would be the primary spectra is coming from the coma. which is a mixture of, well, primarily gas, or ionized gas. I'm not sure what the portion is from some of the actual solid material which goes to make up the comet. I don't know if anybody on the call here would know what proportion comes from either component.
Well, I know some is coming from dust, so that may be a component for meteors. So, mm-hmm. Mary, do you know more?
No, I was actually just wondering whether interaction with sunlight would change the composition of stuff that's been hanging around for a long time.
It might very well do. Certainly, you would expect some of the volatiles to be sublimated off. Would it get to a high enough temperature that some sort of evolution of the material could occur? I'm not sure what the steady state temperature of the particle would be. Obviously, they're quite small, so. They're going to radiate any heat that they receive pretty quickly, I would expect.
Well, that is certainly a question we can put out there. So if you are listening to the show and you know the answer, you can send it to, you can either go to the Nematode website and submit, tell them there. Send it to me. My email is nick@astronomy.fm. That will come straight to me and I can always pass it on as well. So do that, or we can go and talk to some of the people on the Facebook group who do some very serious research into comet chemistry. So I'm sure we can get you an answer.
Mm-hmm. Okay, good.
Now, unfortunately, it looks like Neil and Guy have dropped from the call, so it probably be the best thing to do would have to say perhaps say good night and wrap the show. We would look forward to having you back, William, and so you can talk to us more. Maybe we even get you one of the other shows, but they go out late in the evenings in American time, like the Event Horizon on a Friday night, which is at 9 a.m. Eastern Daylight, which is about 1 a.m. Universal time. Because I know we can go absolutely anywhere on that show. We don't really mm-hmm. have to stick to meteors and comets, and we can talk about anything we like. So, Guy, are you still there?
Apparently.
I started seeing things going down and people dropping offline on Skype, and I had this little screen come up saying from Skype that Guy Wells had dropped. So I thought, oops, I know Neil has definitely dropped. Guy, before we go, do you have any questions that you want to ask?
To be honest, I'm monitoring the sky conditions here because we're going to have a busy schedule tonight at the observatory, and so no questions. No.
Okay. Now, one question for both you and Daniel, Guy. Would this be something that you guys would get involved in?
You mean spectroscopy?
Well, not the spectroscopy.
Or meteors.
The Nematode program.
Well, that's an interesting program. Guy is the one who's present at the observatory. Guy? Yeah,
to be honest, when we got clear skies, our schedule was completely full, and I used every available moment of clear skies to track near Earth objects. So possibly not.
Well, one thing I will say, this is completely and utterly automated. Like my systems, you know, they're running now. I can go off on a 2-week holiday. I've got 2 terabyte hard drives and then the PCs. I can leave this running fully autonomously, and it works absolutely fine. The cameras come on at sunset, they switch off at sunrise. You don't have to do anything with it to have it working. All you have to do is it's I'm not sitting there watching a computer screen all night, absolutely not.
Angel, are you guys still there?
Yeah, we're still here.
We're still here, Mary.
Yep. I'm
okay, here. I can hear you now. Sorry, it went completely silent for a while there. Sorry.
No worries. William, I'm g- going to get back to you about that. Maybe it's something interesting. Maybe not only for the observatory in London, maybe for me or for people who are interested and ask me if I know what they can do.
The more the merrier. The more people we have in the network, the greater the chance that two or more people will observe the same meteor event, and we can use that data then to triangulate the orbit. And please come on board. The days of recording a video stream to the night sky onto VHS videotape and then playing it back with your finger in the pause button the following day. You speak to some of the guys who were doing this back in the 70s and 80s. That's what they had to do. And better than that, when they did hit the pause button at the right moment and you've got a nice meteor trail on your TV screen, what they then had to do was get some graph paper, stick it to the front of the TV screen.
No.
Start to map the stars in the image and the start and the end point of the meteor trail. Then get your copy of Norton's out, work out the RN declination, convert that to azimuth and elevation. Guess what? They didn't get a lot of orbits out of that.
No.
we can get thousands of orbits every year with very little effort now.
And of course, with the modern TV screen being what it is, you probably end up with nice little squiggles all over it. So I've actually seen someone that did that. They tried to trace an image off their TV screen, took the piece of paper, tracing paper away, and then they'd permanently marked it. They even used a soft pencil.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
Yeah, 400 quid's worth of telly just gone.
Oh, ouch.
The tellies themselves are cheap.
Science, using this method.
Sorry, what was that, guy?
I was just saying, definitely some valuable science could be done using this method with the meteors.
Yeah, and we don't just pick up meteors. The other thing that's good, we're chewing up more time. You're familiar with splites? You know, there's a lightning storm, and you get splites.
Oh, yes.
We pick those up as well. As I say, anything that's moving in the field of view will pick that up. So, yes, I get lots of wildlife and birds and bats and satellites and all sorts of stuff, but get splites as well.
Is the resolution good enough to pick up the ionization cloud after a particularly bright meteor?
Yes, it is. The problem is that the software... I should probably explain how the software actually works. What's happening is the video stream is being led into a circular memory in the computer. Now, if no motion is detected, the contents of that circular memory are progressively overwritten. But if motion is detected, that whole video clip, maybe about 4 or 5 seconds, is saved as a discrete clip on the PC hard drive. So when you come down the following morning, you've got a series of discrete clips that you can start to the view, and you can get rid of the wildlife and the satellites and the aircraft and that sort of stuff. And what you're left with is the meteors. But to answer your question, what typically happens if there is a very bright meteor and you do get a persistent ionization trail, because that kind of hangs in the sky and doesn't move very quickly, the video, there's nothing to trigger the video to continue the recording. And so the video tends to cut out afterwards.
Yeah, because they're not moving very quick. I know I've imaged it a couple of times, and it's moving ever so slowly.
It is, yeah. And some of them can last for a very long time. A researched one actually lit up a paper on it up in Scotland. It lasted for well over 30 minutes.
Yeah, the one I imaged was about 25. And it was, it did hang around.
Yeah, it makes an interesting animation when you stitch all those together and play them back.
It does. It feels like proper science when you do that.
Yeah, you can see high altitude winds and
absolutely, and you can work out the speed and direction. And the one I looked at up in Scotland, you could actually see the wind shear. So it actually penetrated through two layers of atmosphere, which were moving at different speeds, and actually sort of cut the trail in half. And the two halves moved in different speeds in different directions.
Wow.
Yeah.
it's actually quite interesting to see what you can actually do. I wasn't aware of that, so I've learnt something today. You know what? It is 20. We are 20 minutes past the hour. I think this is probably is a good point to stop. William, thank you very much. I really do appreciate you coming on and talking to us. Guy, Daniel, as always, always good to hear from you. I look forward to seeing you guys around. And so I guess it just remains for everybody to say goodnight. So it's goodnight from me.
It's goodnight from me.
Goodnight from me.
And goodnight from me.
Goodnight from me.
Goodnight, everyone, and we will be back next month.
Okay, thanks, bye. Everyone. Bye.
Bye.
We hope that you've enjoyed this program from AFM Radio, the broadcast service of astronomy.fm. This program has been released under Creative Commons license. Please contact us for details. You may find more of our AFM original programs on our website. It's really easy to find us. We are astronomy.fm. You may also find us in the iTunes radio listings near the top of the News Talk section, and also as an iTunes podcast selection. We'd love to hear your comments. Please email us at radio@astronomy.fm. Thanks so much for being part of the voice of astronomy around the world and across the known universe. This is astronomy.fm radio.
Hi, this is Tavi Greiner, Astronomy.fm's Vice President of Communications. If you enjoy our programming, please let us know with a donation to astronomy.fm/donate. We really do rely on your support, and it's true, every little bit counts. AFM.